Hello everybody and welcome to Powering Bitcoin, a podcast about Bitcoin, energy in the broader sense, Bitcoin mining, where I try to highlight all the interesting projects that Bitcoin mining enables, as well as all the cool stories, people, and achievements that live in this industry. I recently decided to turn this podcast into an English-speaking podcast because I realize most of the interesting figures within this space are English-speaking, and so it just makes for much better content. This is the first episode in English, so I'm sure there's a bunch of new listeners as well. So I want to do this quick pre-roll just to give a brief introduction. There is a Telegram group which I invite you to join. There's a lot of people on there already talking about renewable energies, battery storage, home mining, Bitcoin mining in the wider sense, and all sorts of other interesting topics. So you're welcome to join there and join the discussion. Today, I speak to Colin Sullivan, who is the co-founder and CEO of Mintgreen in Canada. We had a very interesting discussion around Mintgreen's application of Bitcoin mining, the advantages, regulation, the Tumblr, which we will get into towards the end. And yeah, without further ado, here is Colin Sullivan. Enjoy. Good evening for me, good morning or good pre-noon, I guess, for you, Colin. Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, man. Bit of a stressy day, trying to fit everything, two kids under one belt. But yeah, it's now 9 o'clock for me. I think it's a bit earlier for you where you are. I think we're connected from Cape Town to all the way to Canada. Where in Canada are you at?
We're just outside of Vancouver, British Columbia, so Burnaby.
All right. Before we get started, Colin, can you give me the actual block height, please?
Yeah, we are at 770,586 for block height.
Perfect. The value of the last difficulty change, what's that?
Looks like we're up to, the last difficulty change was January 16th.
Okay, and the value, did it go up or down?
I think it definitely went up.
All right. How many blocks do we have left until the next halving, approximately?
We're looking at 66,414.
All right. The current hash rate?
All-time high, 271 exahash.
Wow. And the hash price as a result is currently where?
Well, according to our friends here at Luxor, it's $76.94.
Yep, that's pretty abysmal. But hey, this is the life we live. Hello, Colin. Welcome to my show that I've started a while ago. Thank you for taking the time today.
And good to be here.
Thank you. And the request as well, accepting my request to spend a little time, ask you some questions. A while ago, I stumbled over your company and was quite intrigued by what you're doing, because this podcast is partly, to a large part, about fighting FUD and energy FUD specifically. With my background, couldn't sit still anymore. So therefore, seeing what you guys do over there is pretty inspiring, and I definitely want to get the word out as much as I can as well. So with that being said, can you give a little bit of an intro as to what Mintgreen does and to your person?
Well, I mean, firstly, thank you so much, for saying that what we're doing has been inspiring to you. I mean, we've got very strong reception from the industry in general and a lot of support, and it's been humbling for sure. Mintgreen is a clean tech Bitcoin mining company with a focus on immersion systems for heat recovery explicitly. We partner with large scale commercial, industrial, clients that need low carbon heating. Specifically, our target is district energy systems, which is a centralized heating systems for cities, generally with hot water piping, basically under the ground to heat different buildings. So our focus, my background is in thermal exchange. I'm also an MBA. We've been at this for about 5 years, and our first installation for citywide heating is slated for September of this year in North Vancouver.
All right, brilliant. Are all the operations located up there?
So we're producing what's called a digital boiler. And so this is co-located heating systems that are heating a dielectric or non-conductive fluid. So that is the first location where we're going to basically be heating the city. In this case, we're providing minimum load, meaning that on the hottest day of the year, when people are basically only using heat for showers, dishwashers, and the like, we'll be providing the entire heat load for the what's called the central Lonsdale area.
And why did you choose Bitcoin mining to do that? Why didn't you choose, I don't know, AI or data modeling or any other sort of computing intensive application that that turns electricity into heat through processing? Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, firstly, I mean, our pedigree is in Bitcoin mining, and that's our expertise. But the heat loads and the energy loads for mining are far more predictable than certain types of server systems. So, I mean, if you're running Google servers, they are actually built for peak load. So, you know, you'll have servers that, you know, you don't want to not be able to access your email during peak hours of the day. So there will be sort of a lull down period and sort of a ramp up period of the usage of energy on those, where with Bitcoin mining, it's completely predictable and flat across the board. Also, like if you do need to curtail, you know, it's your customers is the Bitcoin protocol. It's somewhat ambivalent to your existence. So, you know, there's no one to be knocking on our door saying, hey, you know what, like your rendering's down if you have to, you know, do some maintenance on the system. So I would say, yeah, generally it's the predictability of the heat that our customers are looking for. And so something that requires constant load, like protecting the Bitcoin network, is a perfect fit.
All right, absolutely. Thank you. You have on your website, there are a couple of figures about the sort of CO2 emissions that you guys are, saving on, basically, by applying these kinds of technologies to generating heat. Can you speak to that a little bit? I think it's 1,300 tons of CO2 per megawatt with Bitcoin mining, mm-hmm. and then another 1,800 tons of CO2 per megawatt for district energy. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is correct. Well, I mean, the heat itself is used twice in our application. So once to secure the Bitcoin network, and another to provide heating to the people of Central Lonsdale. So in the larger number, referring to district energy, the incumbent would be natural gas. And so per megawatt, we're supplanting about 1,800 metric tons of natural gas from our electric source, which is hydroelectric, to the order of 97%. So that's that sort of number. And then obviously Bitcoin mining is a very competitive industry. And that the 1,300 ton number is just basically taken from the best information we had on the energy sources for Bitcoin mining in general. And presuming we supplant exactly that much of the least competitive, which has sort of industry average energy use, it looks like, you know, it's about 1,300 tons per megawatt of Bitcoin mining when you have the typical energy mix of the industry.
And what data sources are you using there? Because there are multiple out there and there's no real specific data point that everybody can, you know, in a centralized fashion relate to. I ask because oftentimes I speak to people, especially from the German community, who criticize Bitcoin. And then often you speak about figures that the Bitcoin Mining Council puts out, which obviously there's an obvious attack vector in that data being not objective. You know, it comes from the industry, so why should it be trusted? Then you get people discussing the tobacco industry, and you know, we would never trust those figures either. There's a Cambridge University application. Then there's also people from the Central Bank of the Netherlands talking about transaction based emissions and all of that stuff. So how do you choose the figures that you apply to your numbers?
Mm-hmm. We took a look at the regions that were mostly involved in Bitcoin mining. We took a look at some of the stuff, yes, put out by the Mining Council. But we took a look at also some, you know, questionable sources like DigEconomist. We came up with about 35% was the number we came up with, 35% renewables. And I think that is probably conservative. I've heard numbers as high as 70%. But that's sort of what we went off of for this particular metric.
All right. And so where does your energy come from to mine?
Well, in our location, it's 97% hydroelectric. So we're taking a green source of energy, supplanting natural gas for heating, and, you know, outcompeting, say, maybe someone on the bottom rung of the Bitcoin network competitiveness, potentially using, you know, a less clean mix of energy.
Okay, brilliant. And for those, because I know there might be some people who are not familiar with Bitcoin mining, and so they might be asking themselves, hey, why do these miners use that hydropower? Why does it not go elsewhere?
Well, I mean, that actually is kind of funny, because we won an award in a competition for startups, an open competition specifically for renewable resources. And that's kind of the first place where we started, where the judges were kind of like, well, you know, if we just get rid of Bitcoin, wouldn't that just solve the energy problem, air quotes here? But the fact is, Bitcoin is absolutely not going away. And so I really think that jurisdictions with clean energy have an obligation to support industries that are energy intensive. Because if you're going to say, well, no, that hydro should be used somewhere else, that's just going to push Bitcoin elsewhere to, you know, say the global south, where, you know, it might be coal, it might be, you know, oil, what have you, the power source. So it's also generally, and in this case, it's also generally like the consumer of energy of last resort. But in the case of, you know, what we're doing here, during a low carbon electrification study, it was pretty clear that not only were we saving natural gas, it was just essentially like these two ideas can exist separately. There can be a 1.2 megawatt mine and a 1.2 megawatt equivalent gas heater existing simultaneously. If you put these together, you basically eliminate half of the need for energy overall because of the duplication of uses. So I would say this brings in a lot of efficiency if you can make use of the sort of entropy of the system, as well as obviously the Bitcoin it generates and the, you know, economic freedom it creates.
Yeah, that becomes a bit of a no-brainer, I think. So actually, you're saying there's so much hydropower that turning it into heat is actually more efficient than using natural gas. Right, because there's so much power. I mean, it's the same case as in Northern Europe, where electricity tended to be quite cheap. That's maybe also a topic we can get into, because there's just so much hydropower available that turning electricity into heat even makes sense over using other resources like fossil fuels. Is that the same case?
I would say it's almost the impetus to move off of. Like, there's a big impetus to electrify globally, I would say, for heat or lower carbon footprint. So in Vancouver in particular, they're trying to move a lot of their heating to electricity in general. But the economics of that are not great. Enter Mint Green. You have a situation where we can incentivize the electrification of these systems. And so make it more economically viable to lower your carbon footprint of a large scale heating system.
And so then you alluded to this, I think, in the beginning a little bit. So you're saying all of your mines are then basically integrated into other facilities. They're not outside of cities. Can you speak to a little bit more about that? Where sort of these mines are located, where the miners are?
These are 400 kilowatt vessels. They're kind of in the shape of a donut. They have dielectric fluid running through the outside, moving to the inside, heating up, then basically being piped to a heat exchanger that interfaces with the municipal water system. So essentially, these are just mechanical rooms with significant power, probably similar to what an electric boiler mechanical room would look like. And they're co-located. They have to be very close to the line because we don't want to lose any efficiency. So at present, we are above 96% efficient in delivering heat energy from our system. And we think we can improve upon that as well.
And so how many kilowatts do you operate currently?
Well, this is going to be our first deployment at city scale. So this one's going to be 1.2 megawatts to start. Part of our mission this year is to get 20 more of these going in North America, 20 more megawatts, I should say. It could be fewer than 20 locations. But that's really where we're going with this. This technology, we have two patents we've filed. We are sort of progressing it with it as fast as possible. But, you know, cities move at a different pace than our industry. I mean, this deal in particular has been in place for, is moved forward from 3 years from the initial introduction. And so now they're ready to take on the load. We've, you know, arranged how the power service is going to come in, the location of it, et cetera. So, you know, filling the pipeline with what's called offtake agreements, so heat sale agreements, is a large part of our business. And then basically fulfilling those obligations is obviously the next step. So we're kind of step one there. And come September, this should be up and running and providing baseload heating for the city of North Vancouver through Lonsdale Energy Corp.
Brilliant. There's a lot of regulation in energy markets and in energy systems, especially because it's, you know, vital to everyday life. How have you maybe dealt with, or how have you, how has your experience been with regulation on the ground? Because, I don't know what Canada's attitude towards Bitcoin mining is. I have a feeling it's not too great, at least from what I've heard over the last couple of years. But how do you pitch that? How do you pitch your ideas to regulators when it comes to integrating with these facilities and basically integrating with a very impactful part of everyday Canadians, wherever you are?
Yeah, we don't really worry about, you know, the general mood or the temperature of the room. I mean, we're doing something that very much flies in the face of the general narrative for Bitcoin mining. We are the lowest cost provider of low carbon heating, and we're incentivizing that. So, you know, for as far as regulation goes, like, yes, we call this a digital boiler. It's not technically a boiler. We will pursue UL certification for this, for these vessels. But technically this is waste heat recovery, and waste heat recovery is a very unregulated space. They're basically just looking for a heat source that they can sort of use. Typically, they would attach a heat pump. In this instance, they do not have to. So we fall under the category of waste heat recovery, which is basically gathering heat from, you know, other systems, other industries, and using it in, say, your district energy system.
Okay, you mentioned something, UL certificates. I didn't quite catch that. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, so this is sort of a electromechanical certification for products. It just makes sure certain practices are followed. We are dealing with something that's, you know, a lot of energy is inside of it. And there's things like EMI you have to take care of as well. So it's sort of a regulatory standard for electromechanical products. It's possible that we may not have to adhere to, but I think it would be a good to for a number of reasons, just from a design perspective and a mechanical engineering perspective. So I think we'll likely pursue at least the guidelines, if not pursue certification as well.
Does this kind of approach get you out of the crosshairs with regards to the moratoriums that are likely going to be put in place or are already put in place in some parts of Canada?
Yeah, Jesse, it's wild that this is happening. I remember discussing with some of our investors that, hey, like, there might come a time where we're going to be the only group that's allowed, not that I want that, allowed to mine in, say, BC, because, you know, just some of the concerns about Bitcoin mining. And, you know, it locally, they have put on something on the order of 18-month moratorium on mining. This particular project is exempt, but it's not for the reasons that I wanted it to be exempt. It was namely because it's considered approved by the utility and by the province already. And it's also below a size threshold that they have not disclosed. They haven't said what the size threshold is. And so, you know, if our next one is larger, that could become an issue. I think education is a big deal because, I mean, these types of moratoriums, I know there's a demand aspect to it, but the angle is largely environmental. And I think that, you know, if they have sort of climate goals, that it's demonstrably Mint Green's products are very much in line with that. And so we need to really educate. And we're going to be looking to make some meetings with various members of the local government to make sure they understand that what we're doing is a little bit different and what we're doing can have a real impact in helping them hit their goals.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it hits the nail on the head, right? 18 months moratorium, a lot can happen in 18 months. This is a global competition within Bitcoin mining. And once operations sort of shift to different locales, like maybe South America or wherever, power is cheap and hydro is abundant, then that does not move again if regulation stays friendly, right? So
yeah.
my question, I guess, is what do you do besides educate? If regulators come along and say to you, hey, no more mining, even though there is no transmission lines, maybe there is low cost of power, water runs down a mountain, and the energy can't go anywhere else, right? So now you're wasting revenue for what? For political side taking, I guess. So I just don't understand the reasoning behind saying, look, you cannot use this this electricity source anymore, because down the line in the future there might be others who want to use it. We don't have any transmission lines yet, but we're gonna forbid it anyway. So this doesn't make any economic sense, right? Obviously.
Is education
the only thing you can do?
Well, I mean, I really think that's, if having a frank conversation around this isn't enough, I mean, we're in a heap of trouble. I mean, the fact is Bitcoin's not really a new technology anymore. It's been around for 14 years now. We're coming to the close of the first quarter of the 21st century. It's quite clear the direction of money, the direction of Bitcoin and this technology. And I think to sort of shut your economy out from that is to be sort of left behind as we move forward. And it just, it does cause me a great deal of concern. But I mean, I think this is wrought of a lack of understanding that companies, you know, like McGreen are out there doing things a little bit differently. Not that I would necessarily say that Bitcoin mining onto itself is, say, quote unquote, a waste of energy, because I don't believe that. I think that you're securing transactions on the order of Visa and growing every year. You know, you are helping people in, you know, countries like El Salvador who've never had a bank account. There's a real social good there that doesn't really get played enough. But I think that what we're doing from even the most cynical lens is unassailable. And it needs, if it's articulated, I can't see how they could possibly have an issue with it.
Most of the criticism, especially around Bitcoin's energy use, comes from people, at least in my experience, that have access to quote unquote stable currencies and that are just not well educated. Is that the same for you guys? Because what you're talking about, you know, all those advantages, Bitcoin as a permissionless transmission network for every African that wants it to be or wants to take part in this, that's not often seen from people who have influence over political decisions and who write columns in newspaper articles and stuff like that. Is that different over there in Canada, or is that the same sort of vibe?
Well, I would say it is absolutely the same, but I haven't sat down with anyone from an institution, public or otherwise, and had discussion where, you know, this wasn't successfully articulated during our discussion. It's very, like, once there's an understanding of this, I think it's quite logical. And you're right, there is a certain amount of, you know, economic privilege to relatively stable currencies, but, you know, there are very few in the world. I mean, you could probably count them on one hand. And, you know, there's nearly 200 countries in the world to varying degrees dealing with inflation from bad to horrendous. So, you know, there's a major impetus, I would say, to think about these other countries as well. But I mean, even locally, the amount of jobs that come out of what we're doing is surprising. I mean, you know, we're hiring mechanical engineers, we're hiring business development people, we're hiring marketing people. It just, there's so many different things than just, you know, maybe one guy working in a mine trying to make sure all the machines are running. But even that, those electricians and all sorts of tangential trades and skills that are involved in it. So one of the criticisms in the article from our government was essentially saying it doesn't create enough jobs. And it's almost like, well, you know, the internet is just for email. This is like 1992 and these servers take up too much energy. And, you know, we don't think it creates enough jobs. It's like, well, you don't really understand where this could possibly go. In fact, that's almost unknowable when you have something as transformative, say the internet or Bitcoin, what type mm-hmm. of prosperity can be created.
Nobody thought of the opportunities that we have today, you know, recording this podcast over the internet or a platform that some company set up on the top of that infrastructure, right? So 100%. Who knows down the line, 30, 50 years, what Bitcoin will enable, right? Nobody knows.
No one said, you know, the internet would save trees by sort of ending newsprint, but it did save trees. So it's just this sort of transitory phase right now where we have a parallel fiat system to Bitcoin where it can seem like redundant and superfluous, but, you know, one of them is on their way out and it's not Bitcoin. And then it will seem very necessary and much more efficient.
So maybe on that topic, what do you have a long-term thesis of what Bitcoin mining looks like in 30, 40 years? So before you answer, I'll maybe go into mine a little bit, right? Because I recently had this discussion with two people who asked me, "Oh, what does it look like? You still have people mining with fossil fuels and stuff like that." And my take is long-term, the hash price will sort of stay pretty flat. There might be bubbles going up, right? But long-term, those miners with cheap electricity sources will obviously win. Those who manage economies of scale in the midterm will have a heavy advantage. And then long-term, I think those miners with additional revenue streams, as the block subsidy sort of subsides and gets halved over and over and over again, those miners with additional revenue streams like yourselves integrating heat into it, those will then long-term push out miners, right? Even those who might have super cheap access mm-hmm. to electricity. If you have the same and have additional revenue streams, you have the upper hand. Is that something you can get on board with, or do you have a different thesis?
I have a slightly different thesis. I think, first of all, 30, 40 years is too far in the future. I mean, I think there's Bitcoin before market equilibrium and Bitcoin after market equilibrium. So how long do you think it will take before Bitcoin is just worth a Bitcoin? It is the statement of the account. I mean, I would say 10 years-ish would be thereabouts. I would think 2.5 halvings or so would be a reasonable estimation. And once we have basically Bitcoin sort of reaching the maximum value, just it's found what it's sort of going for, their efficiency will reign from that point forward because you're not really mining for future value, as is the case presently. I mean, miners make almost all their profit on one out of every 4 years. That's just how the cycle has run. In the future, it'll be more like the muted, a lower hash price. So this could be normal. I think there'll only really be three types of miners in the future. Those that are very large and vertically integrated, that is to say, like they own a power plant or power sources. I would say trapped energy, a la flare gas, will be another one. And beyond that, I would say what we're doing, heat recovery, would be the next one. So if you can find some sort of use for your heat energy, you can sort of simulate low costs in more jurisdictions.
All right. Okay. There is recently or soon, we're recording this before the date, soon there will be a platform launched called TerraHash in Germany by a mid-sized company lead who has also integrated Bitcoin mining into their processes, right? So in the midst of an energy crisis, they have decided to diversify, basically put solar on their factory roofs and use that heat similar to you in a liquid agent to transport the heat elsewhere and reuse mm-hmm. the heat in a boiler. Do you think that, and they, to add to that, they also focus on education. Do you think that is also a additional revenue stream that could play out being quite important in the market? Or do you think that that sort of overall adoption and the block subsidy halving will do the education basically for everybody else.
I see what you're saying. So is this going to need a lot of help, or is it going to be sort of an unstoppable force? Is that what you're kind of asking?
Yeah. That's what I'm asking, yes.
I hate to cop out here. It's a bit of both for sure. I think we have to be diligent, and we have to kind of give as many people an opportunity to understand as possible. But I do think the cat is out of the bag, and I do think the legacy systems are not in very good shape, and I think that will come to bear probably throughout this decade. So I would say that it behooves us to educate as much as possible, but I think that's for the good of your community, the good of your country perhaps, or region, because getting on board earlier is going to put you in better position long term. If we all have to move to El Salvador because they understand it better than your local jurisdiction, and they're kind of ending up being a technological backwater with a lack of prosperity, it's possible. But it's not, say, ideal if you like where you're from. But these are the real challenges we may face if the sort of backwards mentalities start to get entrenched.
Maybe on that note, you recently put out a Twitter post. I think it was either on New Year's, like what's next in 2023 and something like that. Maybe you can correct me. But one of the points you mentioned was educate municipal leaders on tech. Can you elaborate on that? Or did we cover that already?
I think we kind of did cover that. I mean, it's precisely just how exactly what Mint Green does fits into the heating and energy systems of here and other places. When people understand that the alternative is not really electricity, because it's generally not economically viable to use for heating, the alternative is some sort of hydrocarbon, typically natural gas. And we're incentivizing the electrification process, and here's how it works. A light bulb generally goes on. And so having those types of conversations, getting in front of the right people, understanding that, what their concerns are, founded or not, there is innovation going on that can mitigate their core concerns. And we need to represent that in a big way.
Okay, let's maybe switch gears a little bit. You mentioned Mint Green a couple of times now, but maybe you can go briefly into the history of the company. I think you guys have been around for quite a while. Do you started the company, obviously? Who's helping you? Who came on board? How many people do you employ currently? What does the future look like? One more specific question maybe about the whole ESG thing, which we briefly discussed in the pre-discussion. Is that also maybe an additional revenue stream? Did that come in at any point during your history? Maybe you can link those two together.
Yeah, well, Mint Green began in earnest as, three original founders just buying a miner while there was another startup I was involved with, trying to make a very, very large system. And we just worked on it, saw how it was running, learned the industry. Those two are no longer with the company, but as time went along, we started building GPU rigs back in 2017. And one of the founders' parents owned a ski resort in a very remote location that had no natural gas. And we were kind of the mind, hey, if we could just put these units into the resort, they could get heating from it, we could split the energy cost. And so we kind of found a way to decentralize the costs and sort of use that entropy from the machines in a novel way. And these were just simply, air-cooled units. Over time, I had been involved and had a lot of exposure to district energy companies. I had the opportunity to see some immersion systems abroad for Bitcoin mining. And I was still struck by the fact that so many were just wasting heat to atmosphere, even still. And so, I was dealing with industries, petrochemicals, et cetera, that constantly needed heat loads, and district energy as well, and in the temperatures that was roughly in line with what they would need. So pairing those two markets together was something of a breakthrough for us. Presently, we have 7 people here. We're going to be going up to 9 before year end. And then probably in the order of 20-something for the following year, as we'll have a lot more projects to be delivering on as a corporation.
All right. The ESG part, maybe as an additional revenue stream, can you speak to that a little bit? How does certification of carbon credits play a role for
Mentoring? Absolutely. You know, how we actually function is we only sell heat. So we don't sell the product. We get ourselves into a long-term heating offtake agreement. And so typically, because we are supplanting an incumbent in natural gas, there will be an aspect of carbon credits to that, which is part and parcel of, I guess, our negotiation with the end user. So in the instance of Lonsdale Energy Corporation, they've retained the rights to our carbon credits. But that has a very high value. It has a very high value to the city that's looking to drastically reduce its carbon footprint by 2030 and actually get to net zero by 2050. Without solutions that are technical like this, there's very little chance of that happening. So it's the primary impetus for the project more than the cost savings.
Interesting. And then it's just a general body, or as you described, it's already applied. So in future projects, there's just a general governing body over this in Canada that you apply to and say, this is our project, this is how much emissions we are mitigating by using this technology. Please certify this and give us the appropriate amount of carbon credits. Is that how it works or not really?
Generally, yes. Because, I mean, there's a few things to consider. Again, the incumbent technology you're replacing. As I alluded to earlier, you could also look at the Bitcoin network, whether that's accepted or not as a metric. But also the energy source is also plays into this. So if you look at one or two or three of those items, and you sort of get a incremental or even significant reduction in CO2 emissions by its construction.
And there's a central governing body that regulates this.
It's provincial where we're from here. So I think each province in Canada has a slightly different program. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean, they would have to be reviewed in this instance. It has, and it's been found to be reducing at least 2,000 tons of CO2 per year.
And the incumbent company that provided heat using natural gas, what did they say? Or were they on their way out anyway, and you sort of won the auction because you offered lower prices? Or how did that come about?
Not quite. See, we're actually providing them a better technical solution. So they would be purchasing additional, let's say, natural gas boilers. In this case, they're working with us. So we're basically providing a service of heat to them and partnering with them. We're not looking to be, at least not at this stage, a district energy company ourselves or be a utility ourselves. We're just looking to supply utilities with low-cost, low-carbon heating.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
Or rather, lower cost.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, you're striking a partnership and you're delivering cost-saving technology, which on paper is a no-brainer. So why not, right?
Yeah, in this case, it's long-term too. So we're looking at sort of 12 years for this particular landing spot.
And I'm sure that incumbent operator using natural gas did not stay unaffected by the current global developments, especially on energy markets. Can you speak to that a little bit? Maybe did it even help in a very precarious way that gas became so insanely expensive over some time? I know it's come down a lot already, I think. I don't know what the current value is of gas on the market, but maybe, you know, instead of expanding with very expensive gas boilers now, that also helped you kind of to say, hey, we're just going to use hydro and mine Bitcoin and provide you the heat that way.
Well, this industry we're dealing with is very conservative in general with their decision-making process. And I would say that gas markets, I mean, it's not, I would say gas markets are much more fragmented than, say, oil markets. So in general, I would say that gas has maintained reasonably reasonable prices out here as opposed to what I've heard in Europe and seen in Europe. So I would say it didn't really play into it. What is constantly in these companies' minds, though, is are carbon taxes going up? This is a known unknown. How high are they going to go? How much is it going to cost us? And it's a real thorn in their side when they're modeling using natural gas, because yes, the commodity itself can get more expensive, but they could also slap on, you know, $100 carbon tax per ton at any time. So this is an ongoing concern to them. And if they can use electricity and they can get a unusually low price given the technology pairing, this just eliminates risk for them and eliminates, you know, potential for regulation that could make it very difficult for them or put them in a situation where they have to replace a natural gas boiler really anyways.
Colin, I think we might have just identified the first case in which governments indirectly helped Bitcoin mining. By saying, yeah. Essentially, if I get that correctly, right? Essentially saying the government sets a value for carbon tax that's unknown. So any industry player that falls under that or has to pay that down the line has an unknown variable, and they mitigate risk by providing heat through carbon-free technology, e.g. hydro and Bitcoin mining. Is that accurate?
I would say that's very accurate. I would say that companies in general, particularly large ones, don't like adding, you know, when the government can add uncertainty to a market like that, that's not something that they particularly enjoy. So this helps certainly mitigate that by, you know, something you can see in paper. This is how much we're paying. This is our proportion. And there's not going to be some sort of known charge that could increase over time.
Interesting. I think we might have to change the title of the show.
Okay, I'll what think are you thinking?
I don't know. Maybe like Bitcoin mining or government helps Bitcoin mining or something like that. It'll generally probably generate a bit of attention.
That would blow some minds for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, cool. So that's the energy crisis. You're saying gas markets in Canada are a bit more fragmented, not as centralized, independent as Germany, my home country, is or has been. And so therefore, but I mean, look, there's a lot of exports as well now, right? So the German Chancellor, I know, has been to Canada looking for energy exports. I know gas and shale gas, I think, which Canada is rich of, correct me if I'm wrong, plays a part there. So generally, I would say, look, if exports go up, there's not as much supply in the country, costs must go up. And therefore, the Bitcoin case is even strengthened with all that hydro debt you have, because now, providing heat through natural gas becomes more expensive.
Certainly. However, I mean, we're climbing down a different national rabbit hole. Canada has done a very poor job at approving LNG export, and to the degree that there's virtually none sent at all. There's been lots of discussions, lots of proposed locations, but there's really only one small one in BC that I know of that's kind of in the works and hasn't started yet. Chevron pulled out, a number of others pulled out. It's just very hard to get that development done in the current market.
This is not really specific to Bitcoin mining, but these questions just sort of pop in my head because I just had this idea of Canada also supplying a lot of hydrogen to Germany, maybe down the line and stuff like that. But yeah, that's, as you said, a different national rabbit hole. Do you have anything else on that topic, or should we jump to the next one?
Well, I mean, I think that if I were to say more on that subject, I mean, Canada is so energy rich, it just needs a single policy, in terms of opportunities for hydro, certainly hydrocarbons, nuclear, all of these options are readily available with resources here. And there just isn't a lot of clarity on policy or how best to move forward. But I do believe Canada could be a real energy leader globally if there was that political will.
Without trying to put you on the spot here, just thought of the challenger to Trudeau. I think his name is Pierre. What's his name?
Pierre Poilievre.
What are your thoughts on him regarding energy and Bitcoin mining?
Well, I don't know too much about his energy policy. I do know that he, to varying degrees, has been sort of orange-pilled. He is explicitly mentioned he's a fan of Robert Breedlove and has been on his show as well. So, I mean, I'm hopeful. He seems to understand macroeconomics, which is sadly rare in his profession. So, I think that he could be I think he's the best option for Bitcoin growth in this country. I would say, however, though, Bitcoin's got to start, putting their own people forward and less hoping other people will champion their cause.
Currently, in the beginning, we alluded to this or named the hash price. Currently, there's a bit of a, in German, you would say Tal der Tränen, a bit of a period of despair when it comes to rewards for Bitcoin mining. Does that guy affect you guys in any
German
way?
German has the best critical? Words, I got to say.
Yeah. It's a very precise language.
Yes,
Schadenfreude and all of that. Everybody knows that one. You know, being happy about somebody else's misery. That's a long sentence in English. Mm-hmm. It's expressed in one word in German. Does that guy affect you guys in any way? Sort of this complete destruction of the mining reward, for the lack of a better term? Or is that really not your concern, because your main revenue stream that you focus on, as you alluded to now during the mm-hmm. Last few minutes we spent, is the sale of heat?
Well, when we spoke earlier, we were discussing sort of our future looking thesis. So, I mean, we have to be in line with a much lower hash price than present. And so we're focused on the technology. That's not really something we concern ourselves with too much. With these contracts, these offtake agreements, we put ourselves in the very, very upper percentiles of competitiveness for the industry. And so ultimately, we expect that we'll be just having perhaps a smaller slice or a bigger slice of a smaller pie rather than any sort of reduction of revenue if price does go down. And we did see a little bit of that here, where there is sort of a bottom where you see difficulty begin to drop off below certain thresholds of price. And that was the last two cycles, actually.
All right. There's something new and very interesting, which in fact made me ask you the question whether you wanted to join me on my podcast for a bit. Mm-hmm. I'm having one as we're speaking. But we'll get into that now. Before I just maybe alluding to that video that was put out. I think it's like a 10-minute video. I watched it. It was very brilliant. Name drop the name of the guy. We can put it in the show notes. And in that video, I'm sure you know which one I'm talking about. You are mentioning also the fact that Bitcoin's energy use is super closely observed, right? More than any other technology, and maybe for the first time ever, technology has to defend their energy use so incredibly. So why do you think that is? And maybe go into the video a little bit.
I believe the reason why it is because there's if I was to say to you, hey, Jesse, what is the cost or what is the energy output to defend the value of the US dollar? You would have to be looking at so many different metrics, so many different discrete sources that secure that, most of them analog, that it makes it very difficult to say what that number is. I mean, we could venture to guess, but to put a number to that is very difficult. Where for Bitcoin, it's sort of a single metric of attack that's reasonably easy to understand. And I think in the face of fiat currencies that are currently functional, It can seem potentially redundant in a transitionary phase.
So you're saying the simplicity of Bitcoin makes it very attackable, whereas the sort of intransparency of the system that you currently live in makes it hard to attack or gives a lot of room for deflection. Is that fair?
The digital nature, the single metric of energy consumption is easy to see.
All right, understood. So what about the video? How did that come about?
Well, this is with Julian Figueroa, who is, he's brilliant, first of all, but he's with his YouTube channel called Kinetic Finance. We've been trying to catch up with each other for a while. He did an interview with one of our advisors, Samson Mo, formerly of Blockstream. He was very fascinated with what we're doing. He really took his time to understand some of the nuance of what we were doing here. And I think he made a video that has been incredibly impactful. My inbox has not been cleared from feedback from that yet. The inbound has been overwhelming. And I mean, that includes you, Jesse. I mean, I don't think we would be discussing had you not seen that. So I think he did a very good job illustrating it in ways that are quite bite-sized and easy to understand. And, we were very excited with the actual product. Shelter Point Distillery, the unit that's in there is very spiritually similar to a digital boiler. However, it's obviously smaller scale. It is a little bit more versatile also, I would say, because it has both a radiator and fluid-to-fluid heat transfer capabilities. It is more modular. It's on sort of casters. It can be moved around a little bit. But we're very proud of it. I think it's a very beautiful machine. And I think it was a good exposure to build some economies of knowledge for our engineering team as well to get that in.
All right. Yes. I think it's already in the show title, right? So some people might have already seen this or know what we're talking about. You called it the Tumbler, right?
Mm-hmm.
You just explained what it is. What does it do, Colin? And how did you get the person who owns the final product to age their product through Bitcoin mining?
Yeah, well, it's called Tumbler because it's clever play on words, I think. We're talking about whiskey, Tumbler glasses. But the unit itself is radially oriented boards that are sort of flipped on their side. And to prevent thermal gradient on a north to south level, it actually has to turn. And so it kind of turns like a Ferris wheel to make sure there's no hot spots on there. It's also a very low pressure system, so it also aids with that as well. We originally went to that location in Campbell River looking to partner with a salt making company that I'd reached out to. I thought the line of the Bitcoin boiling the oceans, because they were literally making salt flakes out of seawater, and I really loved that. But these deals are complicated, and they don't always work the way you want to. But on site, they also had a distillery, which we were introduced to, and that was kind of the angle that took off for us. I think Bitcoin whiskey is very compelling to people in our space, and I think to be part of either the mash process or barrel aging process or preheating process really gets Bitcoin involved in the making of whiskey in a way probably never conceived of before. And I think it's very exciting to certainly our space. These guys are such pros. Like, they don't want any discussion about a Bitcoin whiskey launch until they're sure the product that involves Tumbler is excellent, and I respect the hell out of that. But we're all hoping for a Bitcoin whiskey, if not this halving, the next.
Where can I get one, Colin?
I know, that's what I'm saying. These craftsmen have to be sure the quality is there. But I would like to have a release, around the next halving. We shall see.
So when that happens, you come back and then we talk about all the other distilleries that you've onboarded until then.
Yes, absolutely.
Because this is sort of what my show is supposed to be about, right? Sort of the intersection between energy and Bitcoin, obviously Bitcoin mining, but then also to showcase, cool projects, cool ideas, Because we always talk about how energy is the basis for everything else around us, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there are numerous intersections, you know, all the stuff that's happening in Africa right now with mini grids and all of that stuff. So this is just one more cool project, right? District heating and aging whiskey, mm-hmm. Absolutely perfect. So thank you again. Maybe to close out with a bit of a glance to the clock. I always finish my shows up with the slogan "Bitcoin doesn't use enough energy," which I am not sure where I've heard it, but it stuck with me. What's your take on that? If I said to you, "Bitcoin doesn't use enough energy," what's your response?
I agree. I mean, Bitcoin, I scarcely think the amount of prosperity and how sort of like pro human change that can be wrought from Bitcoin, I don't think it consumes enough energy. And I mean, it nor should it consume so little if we're talking about a base layer for the monetary system. So that is the most high value piece of human infrastructure for transferring value currently. So you can presume that it's going to consume more energy in the future. But I think that also it won't consume more and more and more based on halving cycles. And again, as I just alluded to earlier, based on market equilibrium of Bitcoin price, nothing can go up forever before it sort of finds its range. Once Bitcoin finds that range, they'll be largely relying on efficiency, but also transaction fees to maintain sort of the amount of mining. But even with just relying on transaction fees, I think there'd be considerably more energy used for Bitcoin in the future. And I think that's a good thing.
Beautiful. Thank you, Colin. I had a bunch of questions lined up, which you all answered super precisely. So I had to come up with some quick ones. And I think it made for a very interesting discussion. Give people a handoff, Colin. Where can they find you? What's next for Mint Green? What does Mint Green need? How can we help you in all of that?
You can find us at inform@mintgreen.co. You can email us there. My handle on Twitter is @ccolin_sully2ly. Right now, I mean, essentially, we're onboarding some people. We're looking for bright people. We are in the middle of a round extension as well. So there is opportunity to get involved in our company from a equity perspective. So there's a lot to do here. We have a lot of growing to do over the next 5 years. But really, we just love having, you know, the community here behind us. And, you know, I love hearing feedback, fielding questions. It really fires us up. So, you know, thank you so much for having me here, Jesse. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you again for your time. Guys, if you enjoyed this, anybody listening, making it until the end here. If you enjoyed this interview, please leave likes and all of that good stuff. You know how that works already. I'm not going to be the first podcast that you listen to. Something that I do want to highlight at the end of each episode that I do is value for value podcasting. Check out Breeze, check out Fountain to maybe support the show with some sets. Write me questions on Telegram, Twitter. All of the links will be in the description of this show. I hope you were able to take something away from this, something new, maybe some new perspective that you didn't have before. Remember that Bitcoin does not consume enough energy. With that, until next time. Hello, hello. If you're listening to this, it means you're right at the end of the episode. So thank you for listening. Recently, Relay got in touch with me and asked if I wanted a code. I said, yep, I use them anyway to DCA into Bitcoin. They offer a KYC light, easy way to do that. So just by paying as low as 1% fees, you can stack sats automatically into your own hardware wallet, and that's well worth the peace of mind, I think. Relay is available in most European nations, and they offer an OTC desk for more volume as well, where the ref code is applicable. If you want to support the show and you DCA anyway, or you want to start doing it, I'm happy if you use my code. It'll help me out a little bit without you having to do anything. The ref code is simple. It's just my name, Jesse, JESSE. So yeah, find the link in the show description and see you next time.